Amen. Well, I trust everybody had a Merry Christmas. Thanks for coming out this morning. And if you're joining us online, thanks for joining us that way as well. Back in the day when people used to actually have physical calendars that you put on your walls, on December 26th, you might read this funny little title called Boxing Day, which is not about boxing like Muhammad Ali type boxing, but apparently if you live in the UK and Canada or, you know, Australia, places like that, today is Boxing Day, and it's a day when I guess people go like shopping and they watch sporting events. I think there's some horse racing. I heard there's like a polar plunge that happens if you live in England where you go take a dip in the English Channel. And so like, yeah, I mean, we don't know anything about that here though, because we don't celebrate it. But I don't know if you know this, but I'm a quarter Canadian. My grandmother was born in Nova Scotia, and you wouldn't know by talking to her because she sounds very Southern. But yeah, I'm a quarter Canadian, because so I get like 6 hours today to celebrate Boxing Day, you know, instead of the whole day. But anyway, so you know, the Boxing Day didn't used to be about shopping and sporting events. I always wondered why is it called Boxing Day? But the origin of it is because back in the day, like in England, when people used to have these wealthy, you know, barons or whoever they were, they'd have servants. And the servants, of course, would have to work on Christmas Day. But the next day, the day after, the servants would get the day off. And their masters would give them a box, a Christmas box, with some sort of present in it. And they could take it home to their families and enjoy a day off with their family celebrating Christmas. So that's fun fact. Now you can win at trivia, and you know what Boxing Day is about. But I bring that up because today is Boxing Day, but also because our text for today is gonna show us that life is a gift from our Master. Life, as we know it, is a gift from God, and we're meant to enjoy life, but only if we learn how to put life in its proper place. We're going to be looking at the book of Ecclesiastes today, which maybe you've never even heard of that book before. It's a funny title. But it's in the poetry section of your Bible. Comes after the Psalms, after Proverbs. And it's written, most people think, by King Solomon. And he starts off, and like, literally, when you read the first few verses of this, you're going to be like, why does anybody ever keep reading? Because look at this. He says, "The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem, vanity of vanities, says the preacher." Vanity of vanities. Vanity here really kind of means, like, other translations will say meaningless. It's all meaningless. He says, "All is vanity. What does man gain by all the toil in which he toils under the sun?" I mean, come on, Solomon. Like, start us off with something a little more positive here, but this is what he does. He says, it's all meaningless. And, you know, in the end, he asks this question, what does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? And as he goes on in chapter 1, he answers it by saying, nothing. We gain nothing. It's pointless. Okay, so why'd you write this book, Solomon? Just to depress us? You know, you're telling us that all the sweat, all the hustle, all the toil, it's just a frustrating, pointless cause. You know, you know this. Like, how many of you go to work and you just like run up against the problems, like it's silly problems that don't really need to happen? I mean, people who you think they ought to be able to do better at their job, but they just can't, and it's just this never-ending string of frustrations that we encounter at work or in life. So Solomon says there's got to be more to life. It's got to be. This can't be it. It can't just be a one endless string of frustration from birth to death. So he goes and he searches for more. This is what, if you go read Ecclesiastes 2 and 3, he's talking about all the different ways that he tried to find meaning in life. He says, I tried to find it in wisdom. Tried to find it in riches. I tried building lots of cool buildings and planting gardens. I tried, you know, to find it in power. None of it satisfied him. None of it. In the end, not the end of the book, but after he does all those projects, he still left feeling meaningless. And then, you know, in chapter 3, we get the song by the birds, "To Everything Turn, Turn, Turn," you know. That's actually from Ecclesiastes 3, 1 through 8. That's another fun trivia fact. So now you've got two great trivia questions that you can answer on trivia night, or if anybody ever plays Trivial Pursuit anymore. But then we get to our text today, which starts in verse 9, chapter 3, verses 9 through 14. In verse 9, he repeats his question from chapter 1, verse 3. He says, "What gain has the worker from his toil?" So he keeps asking this question, and maybe he felt like we feel, again, when we encounter these frustrations, when we encounter the effects of the fall, the effects of the curse of our sin, when we encounter that every single day, we are tempted to give up, or we're tempted to just become cynical, or we're tempted to, you know, to just give ourselves over to a life of materialism and pleasure seeking, right? I mean, that's what we're tempted to. But there's good news. In Ecclesiastes 3, we start to see a thread of hope. Solomon, by the end of the book, he actually is somewhat hopeful, but at least here we start to see the first glimpses of that there actually is hope and meaning and purpose in this life, that we can actually enjoy this life if we learn how to put it in its proper place. And we see that, the first way we see that is we enjoy life best when we see all of life as a gift from God. This is verses 10 and the start of verse 11. He says, "I have seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. He has made everything beautiful in its time." That word for business there in verse 10 doesn't necessarily mean your business, like your work. It could be whatever your main task in life is, whatever keeps you busy, whatever season of life you're in. So maybe that's you're a student. Maybe, you know, you're a corporate employee. Maybe it's that, you know, you work at Amazon, or you're a business owner, or maybe it's, you know, the ministry that you do on the side. Maybe it's your service here at the church, or maybe it's a season of suffering that you're going through. Maybe it's just a season of parenting that you're going through. Like you're in a season of raising little kids, you're in a season of raising teenagers, and you just switch the physical problems for the emotional problems, right? You know, the problems are not as easy to solve anymore. Or maybe you're parenting adult children, and they've moved away, but they still depend on you, and maybe that can even be harder in some ways. Maybe you're going through a health crisis. Maybe you have a lot of just relational brokenness in your life. Whatever situation you have, this is all encompassing. This word business, it's all encompassing. The business, the situation, the season of life that you're in. Solomon is saying something very interesting here. He's saying it's a gift. That it's a gift given to us by our Creator God. God purposefully intends for you and I to be in whatever season of life we're in right now. And if you are suffering right now, if this is not a good season of life for you, if you're very frustrated right now, if you're very unhappy right now, you're probably thinking, you're crazy. It's not a gift. No way. But here's what Paul says in Romans 5, 3 through 5. "Not only that, but we rejoice in our sufferings, knowing that suffering produces endurance, and endurance produces character, and character produces hope, and hope does not put us to shame, because God's love has been poured into our hearts through the Holy Spirit who has been given to us." So you see, suffering itself is not a gift. Suffering is a part, it's an effect of the curse. It's an effect of the fall. We suffer, why? Because of sin. Sin has broken everything. But God produces things through suffering that we can't get anywhere else. What God produces in us, the perseverance and the endurance and the character, the hope, we can't get that any other way but through suffering. Suffering and depending on God. And so even suffering, even difficulty, can be seen as a gift from God. And this is kind of what Solomon means when he says, God has made everything beautiful in its time. That word for beautiful in the Hebrew is actually, it's probably better to be translated as appropriate. God has made everything appropriate for its time. In other words, wherever you are right now is right where God needs you and wants you to be. You're not out of place. That doesn't mean that we can't ever hope for something better. That doesn't mean that we can't strive to get out of our suffering or strive to get out of a situation that we feel like is a bad situation for us. I mean, especially if you think, you know, like you're in, like maybe you're in a situation where you're around somebody who's abusive. That doesn't mean stay there, okay? But what this is saying is that wherever you are right now, unless God moves, unless God changes your situation, you are where he wants you to be. And sometimes that's frustrating. Sometimes that's hard to believe. I heard my college professor told us about how when he was a teenager up in Minnesota, he worked at a factory where they made teddy bears. And his job was to glue the noses on the teddy bears. Like that's the only thing he did all day. Noseless teddy bear comes by on the belt. Nose goes on. Repeat. All day. All day. I mean, I cannot imagine, right? I mean, how is that? How do you find meaning in that? How do you find meaning in a menial job where that there's only one thing you do all day? And yet, what Solomon is saying here, what the Bible is saying here, is if you know who created you, if you know that God is sovereign, that he's placed you there, he intends you to be there, then we can start to look for reasons why we can have meaning in a job like that or a situation like that. Maybe, again, to go back to the teddy bear factory, God's put you there to provide for you, to provide money so you can have a car or have a place to live. Although I don't know if you can live off of a salary at a teddy bear factory, but maybe as a teenager it'd be okay. But what else? I mean, maybe he's put you there so that you can bring joy into the life of kids who would prefer to have a nose on their teddy bear. I mean, what kid wants a noseless teddy bear? I know I wouldn't. Or what about like how you are in your workplace? As you sit there putting noses on your teddy bears, are you grumbling and complaining all the time, or are you actually glorifying God in some way? Maybe God is using you in that workplace, and your character, your Christ-like character on display for your coworkers is a witness to them. By the way, I've learned something. I'm never going to not have a water bottle up here. If you were at First Service Christmas Eve, you understand. So if you read the Gospels and you look at the life of Christ, there's all sorts of things we can observe in him, right? But one thing you'll see is that he never complains. He never complains about interruptions. He never complains about people. He definitely confronts people and he calls people out, but he doesn't complain about his circumstances. So like when he's walking through the crowd and the woman who's been bleeding for 12 years comes up and touches his robe, he turns around and is like, "Who touched me?" But then you know what he does? He deals with her. Like he ministers to her. He doesn't complain that she like interrupted him and kept him from going to see Lazarus. No, he lovingly ministers to her. Or like when the people are bringing children to him and his disciples are like, "Y'all, come on. He doesn't have time for that." He's like, no. Let them come to me. Christ does not complain about his circumstances because he knows that they're from the Father. They're a gift from God. Even in Gethsemane, when he's about to go to the cross the next day, he actually asks, "Father, can you take this cup from me? I don't want to do this." But he says, "Not my will, but yours be done." So he knew that all of life was a gift from his Father. And we can't be Jesus. That's not what I'm trying to say here. But we could be more like him. We can learn to depend on him the way that he depended on his Father. But even as we do that, even as we learn that, even as we grow in our Christ-like character, there's always going to be this tension in our lives. There's always going to be a gap between our condition and our calling. Okay, we're always going to have this feeling of like, yes, I'm starting to get it, but I feel like I'll never get it, you know? And that's where we go in the next part of verse 11. Solomon says, also, he has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. So what does it mean to say that he has put eternity into man's heart? Well, that word for put in the Hebrew, it's a silly little word, put, we think, but actually it kind of means the same thing as to give. In other words, God has gifted man with eternity in our hearts. He has given us the gift of being eternal beings. We have mortal bodies right now, obviously, but we have eternal souls, and we know that if we know Jesus Christ, that one day we will have eternal bodies just like he has right now. That's what we will have on the last day when there's a general resurrection. Our souls will be reunited with our bodies, and they'll be perfect eternal bodies. So we are eternal beings, and because of that, that means that we have eternal desires. We have a desire for things that bring lasting fulfillment, lasting joy, lasting satisfaction. We want to be eternally satisfied. And the ironic twist of the knife is we can't. Not right now. Not in this life. Not with anything that's a created thing. I don't know how clear it is to you in this text, but Solomon is frustrated here. He's saying, you know, I cannot find out what God has done from beginning to end. I can't know it. He's saying, I have this limit, these just painful limits on my knowledge and on my wisdom. I want to know, but I can't. Think again about a time in your life that you felt has been seriously frustrating, or a time of suffering. Have you ever asked God, God, why are you doing this? Why are you allowing this to happen? We don't know. We may never know. I mean, we can't think of a reason because we are limited. We have such limited knowledge. We have such limited wisdom. I mean, you ever wonder why every generation thinks the world's going to end with their generation? Like, everybody's always scared about the end times because we can't imagine life without us. Like, that's how limited we are. We're like, we have this 70 or 80 year scope of life where we think about, you know, this is my life, and by the end of it, I'm sure the whole world will probably be gone too, because I just can't imagine life without me. But that's how limited we are. But here's the thing. Just because we cannot know a reason why something might be happening doesn't mean there isn't one. In other words, because of our limitations, we have to be able to see that there actually is someone out there who isn't limited and might have a good reason for the way things are or how things are happening in our lives that we just can't know and comprehend. I mean, we see that with big picture questions too, like creation. We have a biblical account of creation in Genesis 1 and 2, but all we really know is that God created, and there's something to do with 6 days, but we don't know if those 6 days were 24-hour days or if there were actually long periods of time. There's actually a lot of debate over that within the evangelical church, and a lot of solid Christian biblical scholars believe one thing or believe the other. And it's hard to know who's right, because guess what? We weren't there. And the Bible's not meant to be a precise play-by-play, like it's not a scientific account of creation. It's an account of creation that's meant to point us to one truth, and that's this: God made everything, and he said it's all good. So we don't know exactly what happened in creation, other than that God created and he created everything, and he created man and woman, and then they messed everything up. Or how about this? Why does God save some people and not others? We don't know. He tells us it's his choice, it's his good pleasure, but we don't really know why. I don't know why me and not someone else. Ephesians 1 says, in love, he predestined us for adoption to himself as sons through Jesus Christ, according to the purpose of his will, to the praise of his glorious grace, with which he has blessed us in the beloved. So we see a reason, according to the purpose of his will, but it's just basically saying it's because that's what he wanted to do. We don't know why. We don't know how he makes that choice. We don't know what factors he takes into account when he makes that choice. We can't know that. We are so limited. We have a desire for infinite knowledge, and God's determined it's not available to us, and it won't be in this life. So there's always this massive gap between our calling, like what we desire, and our condition, which is what we can know. There's a massive gap between those things, and it's frustrating. And you know what it does is it causes us to put eternal expectations on temporary realities. And we see that in something as innocent as Christmas Day. You know, my kids, as we started maybe a couple days before putting presents under the tree, just the anticipation, it's intoxicating. You know, it's just this, oh, I can't wait. And they wanted to open presents on Christmas Eve morning. And I'm like, no. It's called Christmas Eve. If you're going to open any presents on Christmas Eve, it has to be in the evening. And so we let them open a few things on Christmas Eve. And then on Christmas morning, it was the big day, and they were mostly thrilled. I mean, Isaac is riding around outside shirtless in his pajama pants on his new bike. Caleb played Power Ranger sword fight with everyone, me, Jennifer, Isaac, all four grandparents. They all played Power Ranger sword yesterday. I think maybe even one of them had a Power Ranger mask on at some point. Elijah built an awesome new Batmobile Lego Technic thing with like 8,000 pieces. Nathaniel got a sweet new pair of Pit Vipers and was riding around on a hoverboard. So great day, awesome day for us. But you know, the excitement, it always wanes. Next year we'll find those things somewhere in a corner, you know, with dust on them. And even last night, Caleb looked at me with a sad face and said, "Wear more presents." Kids anticipate and believe that the presents of Christmas morning are going to bring eternal fulfillment to them. Or at least the kind of fulfillment that we can only expect in eternity. But then they open them, and then there's something inside them where they realize it didn't work. It didn't give me what I thought it was going to give me. We place eternal expectations on temporary realities. Of course, that stops when we become adults. We don't ever do that anymore. Whatever. Every day when I wake up, I'm like, oh, today is going to be a problem-free day. Nice. Baloney. Eternal expectations on temporary realities. You know, we do it with people we love the most. We live in a world where the message is find someone who really makes you happy. That's a lot of pressure. It's a whole lot of pressure. Because how possible is it for another sinner to make you happy all the time when you're a sinner too? Can't happen. Won't happen. And if you think that's what's going to happen, you will be unhappy. Eternal expectations placed on temporary people. No one's going to fulfill us perfectly. No one can possibly do that except for Christ. And if we think that's true, if we think that there's a person out there that can make us completely happy all the time, we will crush them under those expectations. Or if another person thinks that about you, you will be crushed under those expectations. Maybe you've experienced that. And then there's a really dark side to this, placing eternal expectations on temporary realities, and that's addiction. We get addicted to all kinds of things, substances, gambling, sex, whatever it is, we experience some kind of a high, right? And then we go on a pursuit of the next high. And then, and this is how addiction works, you get that thing that you got the high from initially, and then the next time you use it or do it, the high is not as strong. And so you think, I got to get more. And each time you go back to the well, the high is not as strong. Before you know it, you're so addicted that you can't not have it. That's how addiction works. And if it was possible for us to be satisfied by any created thing in this life, there would be no addictions. Because we'd have it one time and we'd be like, that was it. I'm fulfilled. But it's not possible. There is a massive gap between our condition and our calling. Is this a cruel trick that God is playing on us? No. Remember, it's our sin. Our sin is the biggest problem. Our sin is what caused the curse of creation to happen in the first place. But even God will turn evil for good. Even God will use this gap that we experience, the tension that we experience. He'll use that to teach us about anticipating something, like Advent. Advent is all about anticipation. We look at the first coming of Christ and we anticipate the second coming of Christ. We of all people are to be hopeful because we have something to anticipate that we know will fulfill us. And so the key here, I think, is simply that even though we have this tension, we know that God is using it to teach us to anticipate and to have faith, to trust Him. We are limited. We cannot know everything. We cannot be everywhere. We can't be all things to all people, but we know the one who can, right? And so we get to, this is another way we learn how to let God do those things. Let God be the one who's all-knowing, all-powerful, and all-present. And just accept that we can't be that. It's a very freeing thing when you accept that. That's what living by faith looks like. And as we live by faith, we get to the last thing, which is that we enjoy life best when enjoyment leads us to worship. So he says in the last three verses, I perceive that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man. I perceive that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken from it. God has done it so that people fear before him. So there's really three ways to respond to the tension that we talked about in point two. One is we can try to work for the eternal, and this is every man-made religion you've ever encountered, whether it's Hinduism or Islam or Mormonism or whatever. They all think, I'm going to work to God. I'm going to work my way to the eternal somehow. Okay, so then the second thing is something that, as we read this, we might think Solomon is kind of suggesting here. It's sort of the YOLO life, right? It's like more of, you know, people who consider themselves to be a-religious or not religious. They're more just living, this is all we have, let's just live it up now. You know, and so Paul even talks about this in 1 Corinthians 15:32. He says, if the dead are not raised, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. So if we can't experience true fulfillment in this life, then we might as well just spend our lives trying to get as close to it as we can. Let's just live it up. We got nothing after this life anyway. But that's not what Solomon is saying. That's certainly not what Paul is saying. Paul is saying, obviously, Jesus has been raised from the dead, and so that changes everything. And so that leads us to the third way, which is that we see that life is a gift from God, and that it's cause for us to worship God. He says man's role in life, Solomon says, is to be joyful, to do good, to eat, to drink, and to take pleasure in all his toil, and that this is God's gift to man. That's the key, that this is God's gift to man. Excuse me. So if the dead are not raised, if it's just you only live once, then our enjoyment of things, our enjoyment of these created things that he's talking about, of being good, of being joyful, of eating and drinking and taking pleasure, it's got one purpose. It's just to make us happy. We live in a country that thinks that that is our highest aim in life. How happy are we? How's that working out? It's not. It's not working out great. Life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, not working out great. I mean, we have a lot. We're very well off, at least some of us, but pursuing these things just for the sake of being happy and enjoying them is not going to work. But when we pursue these things as an act of worship, as seeing them as gifts from God, then we understand what life is about. Then we understand that everything we do can be an act of worship. So like if you go to the beach tonight and you enjoy a sunset and you think about the fact that you're here in Florida on the day after Christmas and you're at the beach and there's people probably somewhere freezing, you think, oh yeah, I enjoy this good gift from God, right? You enjoy a nice glass of fine wine, or you enjoy just a great Christmas day with your family or friends. You know, any of those types of things, they're ways that we tap into those eternal desires that we talked about. The desire for the eternal instincts that we have, they're meant to direct us somewhere other than just to ourselves, other than just to that created thing. They're meant to direct us to their creator in worship. But without the knowledge of who God is, or if to put it another way, if the dead are not raised, then we put creator expectations on created things. And this is why it's such good news that Jesus came, that Jesus died, that Jesus rose from the dead. Because he did, we actually have something to anticipate. We actually have a place to direct those eternal desires. Revelation 21, 5 and 6 says, "And he who was seated on the throne," said, but this is describing the new heavens and new earth, by the way. "And he who was seated on the throne said, 'Behold, I am making all things new.' And he said, 'Write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true.' And he said to me, 'It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty, I will give from the spring of the water of life without payment.'" You catch the reference there to how Jesus calls himself living water. You know, he says to the woman at the well, "I will give you living water and you'll never be thirsty again." And then he's saying here in John, in Revelation 21, in the new heavens and new earth, you're going to get to drink from that water. He's saying the gap between our condition and our calling will be finally closed, because we'll be with him. We'll be with the person that we are meant to be satisfied by, the person who him alone can bring us lasting fulfillment. That day is coming. And maybe, who knows, maybe we won't have any more limits on our knowledge either. We get to ask him all these fun trivia questions that we don't know the answers to. But even though that time has not come yet, you see how we can start to find this type of fulfillment in him right now, in being with Christ, in knowing Jesus right now, and walking with him, in living our lives, our whole lives, as an act of worship, as presenting our lives before him as living sacrifices. But then also specifically on a day like today, on the Lord's Day, worship is of the utmost importance. Look at what Paul Tripp says, and we'll close with this. He says, "Corporate worship is designed to progressively free you from your addiction to the creation, while it deepens your affection for the Creator." So corporate worship, in a way, we're practicing for eternity right here. We're learning how to lessen the hold that created things have on us, on our hearts, and learning how to depend and find our fulfillment on our Creator. So let's pray, and then we'll practice that a little bit.